This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Today is World Press Freedom Day. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and I have in the studio with me Bob Teo, who was working as a journalist on October 27, 1987, the day Ops Lalang was carried out. Ops Lalang is the police code name for an operation that saw the publishing permits of four newspapers revoked and 106 individuals arrested under the now repealed Internal Security Act. His former roles have included senior columnist at Hsinchu Daily, Secretary General of the National Union of Journalists, as well as a reporter at The Star. Today I'm going to be asking him what it was like to be a journalist during that period and how it changed the media landscape in Malaysia. Bob, to start things off then, why did you want to be a journalist?
I was young and naive then, so people my age thought we could change the world. But it won't change. We didn't change it.
And what was the mood like among you and your colleagues leading up to October 27, 1987? Did you see this coming?
In those days, we were very active in the National Union of Journalists. We were fighting the Official Secrets Act. We were aligned to many human rights groups, and there was a sort of excitement in the newsroom. Of course, there were those pro-BN and those anti-BN. So it was full of drama every day. There is never a dull moment. But we expect things to be coming.
And when it did come, how did you find out about the suspension? Where were you at that point in time?
I can't remember, but it came very... what was shocking, but it came faster than we thought. And it was very immediate, and it's actually very terrifying because of the magnitude of the clampdown.
And I suppose, you know, for most of us now, we hear about this, I suppose, via WhatsApp most likely, or we'd be receiving text messages. Mm. At that point in time, what was it like? Was it phone calls? You know, were people writing to one another?
Yeah, of course, there were no handphones, so it's always a phone call, or somehow or other people get to know things, yeah.
And that's how the word spread?
Yeah.
What was your immediate reaction? Was there a fear that journalists would be the one who'd be targeted next?
Initially, we like, what's happening, you know? So we had to take stock, like, what's happening? Then next was, oh dear, could it be us also? So that sort of fear that was going through, yeah.
What did you do after losing your job as a correspondent at that point?
At that time, I was in between jobs. I just left Business Times. I was still the Secretary General of Confederation of ASEAN Journalists, and I was just taking up my job as a country correspondent for Asia Magazine, now defunct. And the first 2 days, I was just wondering what is happening, talking to friends, and we were scheduled to meet in Jakarta with a CAJ meeting. So the question, shall we go, shall we not go? So we said, okay, after 2 days, it's quite safe. They're not after us. So we went. Then when I was in Jakarta, I got a call from a friend. He said that, hey, your name is on the list. So the question is, do I come back or not?
And you talked about, you know, needing to kind of take stock of the situation to kind of really not just have that knee-jerk reaction. So what did taking stock mean? You know, were you just kind of waiting to see if something would happen?
We're going to see that. Is this all after the first two rounds of arrest? I think 100 over, but actually it came in three sweeps. After the second round, we were thinking, is this the beginning or is this the end or what is going to happen? After all, after the two rounds, many were already taken in. So who else do they want, sort of thing? So we're quite unsure what's happening.
Were you mentally and emotionally prepared to be taken in?
Yes, because when we are involved in human rights and trade union, it's always like we are prepared. The question is when.
No newspapers at that point would take in Star and Hsinchu journalists. Were newspapers in general hiring?
Generally, after the clampdown, newspapers were extremely careful, and people like us will never be employed again. Okay? And in those days, you don't have news portal, so basically you're out of a job.
And when the license was reinstated, many journalists were actually eager to go back and work at the Star and Hsinchu, even among those who had secured better paying jobs elsewhere. Why did you think that was the case?
About the Star, I'm not very sure, but Hsinchu, I know a lot because we were also doing things for them as a union. What happened was that Hsinchu has a core of very committed journalists, and they stayed despite being having no jobs for 5-6 months. They decided to stay together. And meanwhile, they took part-time jobs. And then when reopened, they stayed on. And later on, the crop of senior editors you see in Hsinchu today are from that group that stayed back. And that's why they are so good and they became number one in no time, yeah.
Why did they... was the choice to stay back part of loyalty or was it idealism? You know, what was the motivation behind deciding to really stay and wait for this newspaper?
Okay, Hsinchu then was actually an independent paper. It was owned by a business, but it essentially, editorially, it was independent and it was helmed by C.C. Liu, who spent 50 years in Hsinchu. So it was his mentoring of the journalist that they followed him. So he stayed back. He was offered a job, but he stayed back. So the rest decided to stay back. So it was for the sake of good journalism that they stayed back.
Was public perception of the Star and Hsinchu aligned with optimism among its journalists?
At that time?
Yes.
Star, I'm not very sure again because I had less Star by then. But Hsinchu is because of this that they have been a paper for so long and they were determined to hang on until it reopened, yeah.
So having lived through Ops Lalang, you know, and now looking back, it's often described as such a, you know, a landmark moment in press history here in Malaysia. Mm. How did you feel it changed the landscape now that you've had, you know, the benefit of these almost 30 years?
Yeah, first, the impact of Operation Lalang was, of course, it silenced not only the media, but it silenced dissenting voices, and it silenced everybody. Nobody wants to talk anymore, and you know, everybody is scared. And Star, as it recovered initially, but now it is very extremely careful, although Hsinchu went its own way. So basically, that was the thing, that the freedom of expression was curtailed severely. And now, looking back, the question is, will it happen again? I say, no, it won't happen again because the media scene has changed, technology has changed the media scene, and we've got very much more younger people coming full of enthusiasm and idealism, and it's hard to quieten these young voices, and technology allows them that space. So I don't think anybody can do Ops Lalang again.
And with the changing of the media landscape, you know, specifically, when you say it quieted down, you know, what was it like publishing immediately after that? Were the stories, you know, was the atmosphere in the newsroom a lot more somber? Was there a lot more self-censorship?
Yeah. One noticeable phenomenon has come out of the Ops Lalang, that it is word sensitive. It began to, everything is, oh, but that's sensitive. I keep hearing this word until today. Reporters are so drum in that everything is sensitive. You know, I can't do this because it's sensitive. So I ask them, who told you it's sensitive? Yeah, is it sensitive? You know it's sensitive. It's sort of a built-in fear mechanism and a self-censorship mechanism that the journalists censor themselves because of this fear of so-called sensitive issue.
You left the trade for a while. Why did you come back to journalism?
Oh, I actually migrated after the Ops Lalang because there was no more job and my daughter needs an education. And after 6 years, I started to return, not to journalism, but I went to train as a priest, as a pastor. I came back, did some church work. Eventually, I met Ketat and Bun Ken, who was the director of The Sun. So I said, why don't you join The Sun? So I joined them. The Sun for 2 years, then we were all sacked again. Then I left and do some church work. And then later on, since you asked me to join them, I said, I can't write Chinese. They said, never mind, run our English portal. So they gave me a job. Then I left for Kalimantan to do some voluntary work with my wife. And I came back, then they offered me again senior columnist job. Then I left last year and to do freelance. So now I do freelance, basically.
And, you know, when you said that when you first started out, it was mostly to do with the fact that you were idealistic, you wanted to change the world. And that was quite some time ago, and you've been through quite a lot since then. What keeps you interested in the field of journalism? You know, what makes you want to continue doing, working in newspapers?
Yeah, I told you that at the time I was young and naive. So after 40 years, I was still young and naive. That keeps me in the thing. And I essentially love writing. So the right thing to do is to write.
And in your view, then, what should be the role of the press in national life, in national discourse, in national culture?
The role of the press is very simple. Is to keep the public informed so that the public can make decisions on an informed basis, and to speak the truth, to present facts accurately, timely, truthfully, and not to make decisions for the readers. Let the readers make their decision. So that calls for courage. Okay, that calls for courage. So the point is that if anyone wants to be a journalist, that understanding must be there. If you are not committed, you're not courageous, and you're not committed to freedom of expression in the press, then you're in the wrong place.
And how do you train young journalists who have... I mean, 1987 is long ago enough that you have people working in newsrooms now who are not born at that point in time. So how do you train journalists out of that idea of sensitivity, and how do you train journalists who've never been through that atmosphere, that similar atmosphere of fear?
I think essentially we have to go back to history. Those who want to be journalists must know the history of journalism and the role of journalism in Malaysia from the colonial days. Through the colonial days, to the independence, through formation of Malaysia, through Opera Lang, and now they must know the history and the role of the press, and they must see themselves in the context of history. If they forget the history, they forfeit their destiny.
Do you see that same sense of bravery and fervour and idealism with young journalists today?
Yes, very much so.
Going back to yourself, who were your mentors? Who did you look up to?
We look up to ourselves in the first place because we are so lonely and so small. We have no choice to look up to ourselves. And in terms of mentor, we don't really have many. But for me, fortunately, we work under an Indian journalist from India. His name is Dilip Mukherjee. He has passed away. But he gave us a sense of professional writing, how to write in difficult circumstances. Of course, in between, we have editors who are quite bold, to encourage us, and this was our inspiration. And for now, when I see people like Keta Jahaba and Tong Kui Ong even, these are the new mentors. The boldness, like Tong Kui Ong as a media owner, is bold enough to say, no, we make a stand on this. Keta as the CEO of Age Group, he's willing to go into the slammer for one night. And Jahaba, he said, yeah, his business as usual, and the three editors. And when you see this happening, you have optimism that the media owners, CEOs, editors, senior editors are willing to draw the line. So this is optimism.
And you mentioned earlier, how we've got a new wave of youth, but we also have a new wave of technology in terms of how you can publish now. Is digital technology a good development for journalism going forward?
Yes and no. Yes, because it gives you the empowerment to do what you cannot previously do. No is because it's so powerful that you have to be careful. It's just like a gun. It is so powerful. You have to understand the technology to use it in a manner that is wholesome and useful to the original purposes of journalism.
So what are your views then on citizen journalism? Because that's one avenue of digital reportage, I think, that's really coming to the fore.
Citizen journalism is good, but we still have the need for the basics of journalism, basics of writing. You have to write correctly, grammatically right, factually right. So that's an area I'm not sure how it's going forward.
And finally then, what is your message for us on World Press Freedom Day?
World Press Freedom Day is a time for us to remember that as long as we are not bold enough to declare press freedom to be our anchor for our profession, we will always remain unfree. So free yourself and start thinking about press freedom and write boldly and forget about sensitive issues. Just write it.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Bob Teo, who was formerly a Sinchu columnist as well as the Secretary General of the National Union of Journalists. We've been discussing living through Ops Lalang and observing World Press Freedom Day. You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.